happy Monday to you. Welcome to Dakota Midday. I'm Kara Hetland, and to say that relations between the U.S. and China are complicated is a bit of an understatement. Our economies and education systems are deeply intertwined, yet there's concern over Chinese computer hacking, cyber espionage, and human rights violations. And to help us all better and understand this complex relationship, the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations is conducting its 9th annual China Town Hall at more than 70 locations nationwide, and one of those sites is in Brookings on October 5th. And joining me now is Damian Ma. He's a fellow at the Paulson Institute, and he joins the program to help us better understand this complex relation. Thank you so much for being with us on Dakota Midday.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start. Last week, I think it was shadowed just a little bit with the Pope's visit, but the president of China was in the United States as well.
That's right. Clearly, the visit was somewhat overshadowed by not just a Pope's visit, but also the surprising resignation of Speaker of the House John Boehner. So, but ultimately, I think when President Xi Jinping of China was in Washington D.C., it did receive quite a bit of attention for the few days that he was there. This was, as most people know by now, the very first official state visit from a Chinese from President Xi. He has visited the United States before and has met with President Obama on numerous occasions, but never in a formal state visit capacity.
Okay, and so what is the difference then when it's a formal state visit?
Sure. The very big difference is obviously there's a lot of pomp and circumstance. He gets feted at a formal state dinner, and they had entertainment. I believe the entertainment was a hip-hop artist, Neo, and there's a 21-gun salute. There's a lot of, pretty high-level pomp and circumstance, like I said. So obviously the idea is to also really get down into the weeds and really have frank and candid discussions on substance, which, judging by the outcomes that we've seen, there was quite a bit of candor and candid discussion behind closed doors.
And do you think that the relations will improve between the U.S. and China?
Well, I certainly think, it was President Xi was coming at a rather challenging time in U.S.-China relations for all the reasons you mentioned before. In particular, obviously, the cybersecurity issue has emerged as another key sore point between the two countries. But I think it was heartening to see that both sides did pledge to some kind of agreement on cybersecurity, particularly on the commercial side. We're not talking specifically about national security-related espionage, but on the theft of commercial intellectual property, which is a serious issue. And both President Xi and President Obama agree that China would not knowingly support any kind of commercial cyber theft of intellectual property and things of that nature. So, and they established a high-level cyber working group to continue to devise what I would call rules of the road, norms of behavior. So on that front, I think there was actually quite a bit of progress.
Talk a little bit about the intertwining relations between the economies and also the education systems between these two countries. We'll start with the economy.
Well, first of all, we have the world's largest and now the world's second largest economy. Both countries, we trade about $600 billion or more in goods and services between our two nations. And the Chinese are increasingly investing in the United States, in various states. Perhaps even South Dakota has received some Chinese investment, and that is going to continue to be a major driver of the commercial relationship going forward. It used to be, for the last 10 to 15 years, it was more about U.S. companies and U.S. investors going to China and putting money into China. But I think over the next 10 to 15 years, you're going to see a reversal, and you're going to increasingly see Chinese capital coming into the United States. So the commercial relationship has expanded beyond just simply trade, beyond, the made in China labels you see in Walmart or TJ Maxx. In fact, you're probably going to see less of made in China goods on your shelves going forward because of domestic labor challenges in China. But instead, you're going to see a lot more direct investment. And, you know, investing in physical assets in the U.S. economy is a vote of confidence in the U.S. economy. So there's the hope that I think, you know, in this area, the U.S. and China will continue to grow and strengthen. And I'll just make a final point. There's also a lot of collaboration and potential opportunities for commercial cooperation in third markets, meaning in place in other developing countries in Africa or Latin America, which is also a place where the Chinese and American interests do align to some extent.
And the education, how are we linked? I mean, a lot more Chinese students are studying, especially in higher education, in the United States than U.S. students
traveling to China.
That is a
great point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a great point. And it's clearly also a two-way street. People-to-people exchanges, particularly in the education and the also the nonprofit realm, has always been a very defining feature of the U.S.-China relationship. You can't just have a top-down relationship for government for this big, complicated relationship to work. So you really have to have people-to-people. So one thing they announced on President Xi's trip was to have 1 million non-Americans learn Chinese. It's kind of a expansion of the current 100,000 strong program that's run out of the State Department, which is to get 100,000 Americans to learn to speak Mandarin Chinese. But now they've basically increased that number to quite a bit to 1 million. So there's that aspect of it. But there's of course the other inbound Chinese students who are increasingly looking for a U.S. higher education. Some of them are starting as early as high school. This is in part because I think, for the parents, for the Chinese parents who can afford tuition in America, they're much more willing to send their kids here because they think, one, it's slightly less competitive to get in than actually some of the top Chinese universities. There are only several top Chinese universities, and it's extremely competitive. Everybody wants to get in there. For example, it's much harder to get into Beijing University, one of the top universities in China, than it is to get into Harvard. So there's a competitive element domestically that's driving people to go on abroad. And, the United States, U.S. academic institutions is a beneficiary of that as well, along with institutions in the U.K. and Australia and so on.
Why is it so difficult getting into the university in Beijing? Just sheer numbers?
Sheer numbers. There's just tons of China's graduating more college students than they ever have in their history. And there are just very limited spots. There aren't that many top academic institutions. Once you get away from the first tier, like Beijing University and Tsinghua University, or Fudan in Shanghai, you really have a declining in quality. And so all the parents want their kids to go to the very top ones, the first tier ones, and clearly, given the population size, there's just simply not enough seats. So it's very, very competitive. And for Chinese students who are not from the local city area, it's often much harder. There's a bias against them of getting into the top university. So if you have the financial means, it's often easier to go abroad.
If you had to design how the U.S. education system will instruct 1 million Americans to learn Chinese, how would you set that up?
That's a terrific question. I think you certainly need to train a lot more teachers. You need to certainly find ways to supplement current capacity. I haven't been in high school in a very long time, but I don't, back in my days, they certainly weren't really offering Chinese, though I know that's changed quite a bit across the United States. And also, you got to start from probably middle school, high school, and the collegiate level. So there's plenty, I guess, opportunities to hire Chinese teachers, whether they're un-Americans trained in Chinese, or possibly there are ways of having academic exchanges to have actual Chinese teachers come and teach in American classrooms. I'm not sure, or maybe using technology. There's obviously things like Coursera and other massive online courses. Maybe that's a way to kind of bridge the geographical gap and allow a lot more students to have access to Chinese lessons.
Well, I know the middle school in Sioux Falls, my seventh grader, is taking a world language class. It is one quarter, so about 8 weeks, and they're covering five languages, including Chinese. So it's more of an introduction, but I guess I'm not certain where it goes from there. I mean, I think she learned how to say hello and goodbye.
Right.
in her first 10 days. You need
and
a little Chinese, more than that.
Of course. And Chinese is one of those extremely difficult languages that even the Chinese mm-hmm. themselves admit as one of the most difficult languages in the world to really grasp. And, you know, to go from sort of an introductory level to a level where you're generally proficient, obviously that's going to take a lot more work and years of dedication. And you got to start early and go through the high school and collegiate levels as well.
Well, in China, at what age are children introduced to learning English?
Well, personally, I had taught English about 10 years ago in Shanghai, and I was teaching kids. This was a summer preparatory course for some of their tests that were coming up for English. And I was teaching kids as young as first grade to as old as people that were seniors in high school, as well as some young professionals, but mostly grade school to high school. So they were starting as young as then. And I think, parents really force and insist that their children learn English. They believe it's the most useful language other than Chinese. And everyone thinks they need it. It's a funny story. When I go to Shanghai and I go to Starbucks now, I often order in Chinese, but I get I get responses purely in English. They won't even talk to me back in Chinese because I guess that's part of their training. There's a whole generation of Chinese who are pretty good with English now. Obviously not fluent, but certainly. Probably much higher than your average American high school kid, is able to speak Mandarin Chinese.
And do you believe that by more Americans knowing how to speak Mandarin Chinese, will that help improve a level of understanding and a level of relationship, and improve U.S. relations overall?
I think
as we
raise
critical. Our children up,
it's critical. It's absolutely necessary because China just happens to be a culture and society that really prides itself on its language, a lot of miscommunications happen because oftentimes because of language, whether it's written or spoken. It really is a critical part of it, and I think. To the extent that more Americans can converse in Chinese and more Chinese can converse in English, that is certainly going to have a positive effect on the bottom-up, the people-to-people relations, which, as I said, is also a linchpin of the broader bilateral relationship.
Now, you're coming to South Dakota next week on Monday, and it's part of the South Dakota World's Affairs Council event and a China Town Hall. Can you explain a little bit about what's going to happen at this event?
Sure. Well, I am only going to be doing part of it. The broader event will be broadcasted from other parts of the country. The National Committee on U.S.-China Relations is one of the oldest organizations that promotes a positive bilateral relationship, and they do a lot of different things, from high-level visits to also the people-to-people exchanges that I talked to you about. And they also often, bring congressional leaders to China to kind of understand Chinese politics and interact with business leaders there. So they're a terrific organization, and I certainly look forward to being there in person to speak to the World Affairs Council in South Dakota. I think it's important for more and more Americans to really understand what this U.S.-China relationship is all about and why China is important to the average American. It seems pretty far removed, but if you drill down, there's a lot of interesting connections between our two countries, dating way back to the 1800s, actually. So, it's just especially important for the future generation of Americans to understand that they're growing up in a world in which China will be the biggest, will likely be the biggest economy in the world, and what does that mean for a changed, a global economy, and how to benefit from potential opportunities of a growing and prosperous China.
And what do we need to do to accept that as well?
Of course.
As Americans?
Of course. Psychologically, that will be obviously a different world that we live in. Whether China becomes the biggest economy in 5 years, 10 years, or 15 years, it is almost likely going to be. But we also really need to have a nuanced and realistic understanding that just because it's the biggest economy, it will still only be about, much, much less per capita in terms of its wealth than America. It needs to have an economy four times the size of America to really be on an equal footing in per capita terms. So at the same time, it's a much more powerful economically, bigger economy. At the same time, it still looks at itself as kind of a developing country. So there is a bit of an identity crisis in China right now, and we need to understand that it is both at the same time, and also how America adapts and adjusts to a new global reality. It's not just about China. It's about all these developing countries rising up, including India, Brazil, you name it. All those emerging economies are coming up. And so, the United States also has to think about its own new role in the world and how to deal with a 21st century where it is no longer the most predominant economy in the world.
Damian Ma, I want to thank you for taking time and coming on Dakota Midday today. I really appreciate it. And I'm sorry to say we're out of time, but thank you so much.
Thank you.
Damian Ma is co-author of the book, In Line Behind a Billion People, How Scarcity Will Define China's Ascent into the Next Decade. And he is speaking at the South Dakota World Affairs Council event, the China Town Hall, on Monday at Daktronics in Brookings.